Now, this story is being told by Commander Mike McGrath, who spent many years in the North Vietnamese prison camp. It's being recorded on a conference telephone in front of my class at Sanger High School that I was teaching, and I think the year was around 1982. The story is self-evident, and it gives pause for thought.
Sanger High is a pretty neat school. And you see in the film, When Hell Was in Session by Jerry Denton, and I'll tell you right off the bat that I think with the half hour they had to work with on that film, that was a pretty accurate representation, and I think that actor, Hal Holbrook, did a good job, especially getting as skinny as he did. That is very representative of how we all were. It's a good way to go on a diet over there. I lost about 50 pounds in about 3 months after I got there. Not the most pleasant way to go on a diet, because you're eating mostly rice and cabbage soup and rice and pumpkin soup and rice and turnip soup and more rice. In fact, when I got back, I wrote a book, Nick. It's called 1001 Ways to Prepare Rice. And after I made $1 million in that book, I wrote a sequel to it, and I called that One More Thing You Can Do With Your Rice. Well, that's enough of the humor. I'll tell you a little bit about my experience there for your class. I was stationed right there in Lemoore, California. I grew up in Colorado, and I went to Naval Academy flight training over to Lemoore to fly an A-4 jet aircraft. And the Vietnam War was cranking up, and those of us who were flying in the military, we knew as a just cause over there, and we were ready to go for our job. Everett Alvarez from Lemoore had just been shot down, and he was the first captive in North Vietnam, and he's well remembered around the Lemoore area. I was on my second cruise. I'd flown 178 combat missions over North Vietnam when I was bagged. And my A-4 was hit in the wing with some heavy fire, probably a AAA, 37mm, 57mm. I bombed one bridge and was going after a second bridge on the way home and got hit during my pull-out. In peacetime, we can often eject from airplanes who are going straight and level, and nobody gets hurt, but in my case, the airplane was spinning out of control and heading straight to the ground, and I had to make a real quick decision, and I chose to pull the alternate handle, and I did get out of the airplane about 3,000 feet above the ground, and it was about 500 miles an hour, so that's pretty violent to jump out of an airplane at 500 miles an hour. Things happen to you that kind of hurt. Like my leg was broken, my knee was broken backwards and hyperextended, my arm was broken and dislocated. And my back had two fractured vertebrae in two different places, so I wasn't in very good shape to jump up and run from the enemy and escape like we all wanted to do. We wanted to evade and escape the best we could, but I was a little too broken up for that. My book kind of parallels my time there. It doesn't tell all my details, but it tells about myself and my roommates. And you can see there, they jumped on me, stripped me of my clothes, held a knife in my throat. And pretty rough in doing it. It took me through some villages and beat on me with sticks and twisted my leg. And when going through the villages, you hear me scream. Took me to Hanoi via truck. On the way to Hanoi, they dropped me off and rolled me in a ditch. I drew a picture of the night scene, and the guys were beating me in the face and throwing rocks, bouncing rocks off my chest. And you know, I said my farewell prayers that night. I said, "Well, you know, God, here I come. Forgive my sins." And I was prepared to go that night, but fortunately, another truck came by, picked me up, and took me to Hanoi. And what I did in Hanoi, I entered the same sequence that all of us did. Over 95% of us went right into torture right after we were captured in Hanoi. Now, this is something the Americans find hard to understand. I don't know why. We were soldiers. We expected that. We knew what to expect from a communist captor. And basically what the communists were after was to break our will, make us violate our vows to the code of conduct and our Geneva Conventions, where we were only required to give name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. We stuck to that as best we could, but the Vietnamese were not going to let us stick to it. They demanded more. Now, I held out for 3 days, the name, rank, serial number, and those were pretty painful days, in and out of torture every hour for 3 days, no sleep, no food, no water. But in the 3 days, I was almost completely delirious and terrible pain in my arm. And at the end of the third day, they twisted my good arm so bad, they dislocated my good elbow. And then I was really hurt. And one point that they held a gun to my head and they said, you know, doctor, we'll shoot you. And I said, go ahead and shoot me. I hurt. Just get this over with and shoot me. And they came back and said, no, you're a criminal. You haven't suffered enough. So I just kept twisting. Finally, it hurt so bad, and Neil was either going to die or tell him something. Well, I started telling him stories and making up anything I could. Like, my dad was a mining and metallurgical engineer. I told him my dad was a railroad engineer on the H.O. Railroad. You and I remember those H.O. Railroad. That was the half-aught gauge toy railroad we had when we were kids around our Christmas tree. And my dad was an engineer, so that made sense to me. I could tell him he was an engineer on the H.O. Railroad, and they bought that. Well, I made up similar stories, all, you know, half-truths and half-distortions, things I could hang on to, because they'd come back and ask you again and again and again to verify your story you told them the first time. Well, this went on for 2 more weeks, and I held on for 2 weeks with no sleep, and finally at the end of 2 weeks, they promised me medical treatment. Well, in 6 years over there, I never did see medical treatment. All they did was leave me alone at the end of 2 weeks, move me in another room, and left me alone. By this time, I was all covered with infection. There was pus all through my hair and around my ears and into my eyes. And my whole body was just about covered with pus. Mosquitoes, of course, were eating on me day and night, so every time a mosquito bit me, that turned into an infection. By this time, I developed dysentery. And I remember I was counting, you know, 40 and 50 involuntarily, you know, bowel movements per day. And I was losing water very rapidly and was going downhill fast. Boils were covering my back by this time. And just a pretty tough existence. And you have to be patient in that situation. You know, a prisoner of war situation is not the best situation. It's tough for everybody. Lots of other guys were hurt there, too. One of the guys across the hall from me had a broken leg, and his whole hip had been shot away. His name was Bill Metzger. It's been shot away by a naked shot his airplane down and had blown away part of his hip, and his leg was broken. Well, they just said he stunk so bad from infection that they threw him in a room and just left him for 3 or 4 months. And all they do is put a bowl of soup in every day and then come at nighttime and take away his body movements and he pushed into the bowl. And just left him in there to stink for about 3 months. Well, he held his leg so still that he got his own leg, his broken bone, to heal in an overlap position, a 2-inch overlap. And he had open wounds, he had maggots in the wounds, but he was smart enough to leave the maggots there to clean out the wounds because he knew the maggots would keep the wound clean and clean out the infection. And after a couple of years, it finally healed up and sealed over. Now, some of us were in solitary for, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Some people were in solitary for 5 years without seeing another American face. A little hard to comprehend. Fortunately for me, I was a lieutenant and I was junior enough that I got some roommates after a few months. And I had roommates the rest of my time there. Then some of the commanders, the senior people, didn't have roommates for many years. How do you live there? Well, living is tough. You're living in a room that's about 7 feet by 10 feet, and 4 blank walls, no chairs. In fact, can you imagine this, Nick? I went for 6 years without sitting in a chair, and you know, without an ice cube, without a cold drink or a chair for 6 years. And people complain back here about a few inconveniences. I don't worry about those things anymore. I'm happy to get everything I get now. Don't complain about anything. I had lots of interesting roommates. We all shared our experiences. I lived with Air Force and I lived with Marine Corps pilots. Nobody ever complained. You know, if somebody was hurt, they kept their complaints to themselves. And it was really a proud bunch of people we were with. And we didn't have the complainers that you had back here in the States during those years. The hippies that were running around the streets and demonstrating and complaining and raising hell. We had a bunch of dedicated professionals in there that were really proud of their country and really stood up for their country. In fact, you know, even when we were solitary on Sunday morning, somebody whistle out the back window about 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, and you hear this, like the dip, 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 da from Victory at Sea. Do you remember that, the code? and somebody would whistle a letter V out the back window, and we'd all stand up in unison, and we'd all say the Lord's Prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance together. We had to say it silently, because if they heard us talking outside of our rooms, then they'd come in and beat you up. So, but that was one thing we did every Sunday. We all faced towards the east, towards the United States, when we said that. Quite a bit of unity in that camp. In fact, we finally named that one camp within the Hanoi Hilton. We named that Camp Unity after we all got together. After the Fante raid, when we all moved in there, we called that Camp Unity because of our unified position to resist the enemy. Well, some of the life in there, well, we had some rats. The rats were as big as alley cats, and they were bold. If you got a scrap of food, you tried to save it overnight, say you wrapped it up in a piece of cloth and put it under your head and slept on it, the rats would come and eat right through the cloth, right under your head, and eat the food right from underneath your head. And, they'd steal anything you had, where they were big and mean and aggressive. I've never seen rats like that before. We had snakes. Sometimes we'd kill bamboo vipers in our rooms, and there was crates and water moccasins. One of my friends, or not water moccasins, the big one that stands up and hits his ass over there. Yeah, I kept thinking.
Cobra?
Yeah, the cobra. Yeah, we had one of my roommates walked in into a room one night, and we just moved to a new camp up by China. They evacuated us out of Hanoi and moved us up by China into a dungeon up there where I spent my last year. And one of my roommates walked in this room, and he threw his bedroll down on the bed, and it was dark and black and dirty. And he finally talked the guard out of a lamp and walked back in this room with this lamp, and there was a cobra right on his bed looking him right in the eye. And he ran out of the room and he yelled, "Snake, snake, cobra." And there was about five guards trying to push about 20 of us into this building. And you ought to see about 26-foot Americans turn around and pick up five-foot-three guards and run out, just like blocking practice. You just run out the other end of the building just with them screaming and hollering, and we're just running out the other way. With a snake in there, we weren't going to stick around. We had one-steppers and two-steppers up there. And one-stepper is you get bit, you take one step and you're dead, and two-stepper you get two steps before you're dead. And we saw one of our guards get bit with one of those things one time, and he took about two steps and he was down and he was dead. It's pretty dangerous snakes. Well, the torture I mentioned, that only lasted usually during the first 2 months, Nick. They worked us over for propaganda. That was a war of propaganda. You see, the communists, that's the way they fight wars. They fight with propaganda. Not only with bombs and bullets and people, but they fight a war of propaganda. And back here in the States, they were fighting a tremendous war of propaganda. They had a lot of sympathizers, people like Jane Fonda and company, that were back here espousing their causes and apologizing for them and saying, "Oh, these communists are really pretty nice guys. They treat people humanely and leniently and apologize for them." But they got an awful lot of media coverage back here and an awful lot of sympathizers back here in the States. Well, what they do is torture us and try to get us to make statements that condemn our country or condemn the war or condemn our government or the president, you know, to say the war was wrong, to say it was, you know, like illegal, immoral, unjust. They had all these neat words like that. And guys would just hang on the best they could and resist the torture and as long as they could. Some people could hold out all the way, like Admiral Stockdale. You know, he's one of my real heroes, Admiral Stockdale. They tried to get him in front of a camera once. And the first thing he did was shaved off part of his head, the top of his head. So half of him was bald and half the other half was all hair sticking up all different directions. So they just came in and sheared that off, got rid of the ugly hair, and then they put a cap on him and said, "Okay, now you're going in front of a camera." Well, they left him alone for a few minutes, so then he took a razor and he nicked himself all up in the face and beat his face in the wall, and beat himself up so badly and bruised himself. He got swollen eyes and scrapes and bumps that when they came back to put him in front of the camera, here was this bloody mess that they couldn't even put in front of the camera to make propaganda. And he went through numerous times of torture, and he was always able to come out and tap on the wall to others, continue to resist, be proud of your country. And for those type of actions, so Stockdale got the Medal of Honor over there, and I think he well deserved it. He was really a tough character. Okay, I mentioned the tap code. Well, you know, it's pretty tough to live in solitary or even have one or two roommates. And how do you live? Well, how do you keep your brain active? Well, we kept our brains active. We worked every day for long periods of time, communicating and memorizing and learning. Now, what we did, I think I mentioned that book, we arranged the alphabet in five groups of five, left out the letter K, and we sometimes substitute the letter C for letter K when we needed a K. But you could tap one tap for the first group, and then like the letter B, it'd be one tap followed by two taps, the second letter of the first group. And pretty soon, I'll tap on the phone here and see what it sounds like. Can you hear that? That's just tap code. And pretty soon you get there, you can listen on the wall, and you can understand tap code. Well, pretty soon we're passing information on our families, what's going on in the camp, who's new at camp, what are the names in camp, and we start memorizing these. But, well, by the time I finish memorizing the names of all the people with POWs in camp, I learned one camp, then I go to another camp, and I learned that camp. By the time I finished, I had 350 names on my memory list. Alvarez, Atterbury, Austin, Bagley, Bailey, Barker, Barley, Barnett, Barrett, Bob, Bell, Bomber. And I'd run through those every day, about 350 names. You remember old J.B. McCamey? He was from Lemoore. Super intelligent guy. J.B. had so many memory lists that if he reviewed all his memory lists for 8 straight hours, he'd still be reviewing memory lists after 8 hours. He memorized every detail of everything. You know, we did Shakespearean soliloquies. We had hundreds of books on our list. We had mathematics, we had history, and you get this from all your friends and roommates that you live with, and you pass them through the wall. For instance, like I mentioned last time that I was there to visit you, aprendí a hablar español. No he estudiado español en escuela, pero ahora yo sé quizás 8,000 palabras en español. You know, I learned Spanish, I learned German, ich spreche Deutsch auch, learned French, and I learned this all from the wall, through the wall, tapping on the wall from different people in different camps. So we didn't let our minds go inactive. We were very aggressive to keep our minds alert and healthy and alive. You don't want to sit there and vegetate. Now, even despite our injuries, too, we kept exercising. We weren't allowed to exercise in there, Nick. So what we'd do, we'd get up there every morning at 5 o'clock before the sun came up. We'd post one guy in the door to peek out from the door, and the rest of us would exercise. It's pretty tough when you're hurting. For instance, I hurt, well, my arm hurt for 2.5 years with real bad pain. But I ignored the pain and just kept exercise. It took me a year to get strong enough to lift my chest off the bed in some of the semi-push-ups. By the end of 1.5 to 2 years, I was able to do 100 straight push-ups. My arm's still broken, but it's kind of mended in a crooked way. And I'd do 1,000 sit-ups and 1,000 leg raises and 1,000 deep knee bends every morning before the guards come to let us out. And here they were trying to keep us weak and demoralized and without food. And we were in there exercising, trying to keep strong and trying to beat them at their game. But you can see we're talking, it's tough times, but our morale was high, our esprit de corps was high, and we had a lot of faith in each other, faith in our country, faith in our families, religion, our background, our schools, all our friends, classmates from back home. We had a tremendous lot of faith going for us, and a lot to hang on to, and a lot to come home to. And I figured I'd be home probably in 10 years. I got home in 6 years, so I wasn't too far off. But we knew it would be a long time because of the type of war that we were fighting. And that phase paid off. Our government negotiated us out and got us out in March of 1973, about 9 years ago. So I've been back 9 years and back to my family. My kids were 2 and 3 years old when I left. They were 8 and 9 when I came home. So I left them when they were babies, and I came home. They were old enough to play baseball and wrestle around with me. And we hit it off pretty good, and now my kids are they're a junior and senior in high school right now, and both playing sports, doing well in academics, and got a real happy family life here. I want to tell you some the positive attitude. Tell your students there, and in fact, I guess I'm talking to your students there. The best thing you can do in life, I think, is keep a positive attitude, and I kept a positive attitude when I was in there, and even though things were tough, I thought good things about the Navy, and I thought good things about my family, my friends, and never got a bitter attitude. And when I came out, I found out, gosh, things aren't really so bad after all. I still like the Navy. I like what I'm doing. There's lots of challenges. I like jet airplanes, and I like to fight, and I like a good aggressive life in the Navy and lots of adventure. And so I pressed on back into aviation, and geez, you know, after 8 years out of the cockpit, I found out flying airplanes is just like riding a bicycle, just as fun and as exciting, and just as easy as it was before. And I got back in Lemoore, California there, and flew A-7s. About the time Captain Nick was still around there, and I think you were going off to carriers about that time, Nick. And got a squadron, I got command of a squadron, and got out in the middle of the Indian Ocean here 2 years ago. I was out there chasing Russian submarines and Russian ships, Cassians and Crestas and Sverdlovs, and intercepting Russian bears and Badgers and Mays, IL-28. Real exciting crews out there, meeting the Russian eye to eye. And fly up alongside that Russian and take a picture of him, and he takes a picture of you, and you give each other a salute and go your ways. You're both professionals in aviation. I finished that career and back here at the Naval Academy, and now it's kind of funny, but that optimistic attitude where I learned all my Spanish is paying off for me in another way, because I can speak some little Spanish. I've got a chance to go to Argentina my next tour, and be the naval attaché to Argentina, and I go to language school and get some fluency in Spanish, and so that'll all pay off. All that hard work I did in Hanoi is going to pay off for me. It was a beautiful, adventurous job in Argentina here for the next 3 years. So things have been pretty good to me, Nick, since I came home.